Okay, Gloria Long Anderson, this is August 21st, 2009, oral history. Tell me, you were born in Altheimer, Arkansas. Tell me about the town.
Okay, it's really pronounced Altheimer, Altimer. That's the way you pronounce it. And it was a town that had 980 people when I went to college, because everybody who came through there teased me about that. We didn't have a stoplight, we didn't have anything. So, Altheimer, Arkansas.
Who founded Altheimer's? You were telling me about...
I think it was named after the people whose name was Altheimer, so I don't know whether they founded it or not. They may have.
And what, you know, for those of us who don't know anything about Arkansas, where is it in relationship to other towns?
Pine Bluff, which is where the college is, the college that I went to, is about 40 or 45 miles from Little Rock. And my hometown is 12 miles, 11 miles from Pine Bluff.
Okay, tell me about your parents. Your father is Charles Long?
Yes.
What did he do?
My father was a farmer most of his life, and in his, I don't know what year it was, but he became a janitor at the... they call it Jefferson, let me see what it is called. It's the Pine Bluff Arsenal. He worked there. And my father finished third grade. That's as high as he got in school.
Okay, tell me about your mother.
Okay.
What's her name?
But
what did she do?
I would like to say about my father.
Oh, okay.
Unlike today's students who come out of high school and some of them can't read, my father could read. My mother was a domestic. She worked in people's houses, which you call those people. And later on in life, she worked at the Pine Bluff Arsenal also she worked in the armament division. I think they were probably working on bombs and stuff like that.
Ooh. What is her name? Was it Elsie Lee?
Elsie Lee Long.
Foggy
Long.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what kind of education she had?
She had a 10th grade education.
Oh.
She could also read, and she also was a seamstress. She didn't have any training in she could look at a dress and do the pattern for the dress, because people would come to her and bring a picture of a dress which maybe they had gotten out of the Sears catalog, and she could do the pattern and make the dress. She was
She's very creative.
Yes. That's what happens with the stroke. Sometimes, occasionally, I can't get the words out here, and I can't.
Okay, that's fine. I'll supply the words.
Okay.
Okay, you had how many brothers and sisters? And
I had five brothers.
Oh, what did they do?
Okay, let's see. Three of them were older than I was, and two of them were younger than I was. My oldest brother, he was a half-brother, and he went to Chicago to live with his father when I was very, very young. So I really didn't know much about him. I know that he went to a trade school in Chicago and took up electricity. Mm-hmm. The next brother, he also went to Chicago. He was a half-brother as well. And he really didn't, my mother wanted him to stay with us until he finished high school, but he decided he wanted to go, so he didn't finish high school. The next brother, older than I was, went to the Korean War, and when he came back, he went to the college, the same college that I went to as a veteran, and he took up brick masonry in a 2-year program. My two younger brothers, now I went to Arkansas AM&N College. It is now called the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff, but at that time it was called Arkansas AM&N College.
Okay, we're going to get to that later. Okay. We're not in college yet. You haven't done elementary school.
But I wanted to tell you because my other two younger brothers went to that same college.
How'd you like being the only girl in the family? Did they brothers kid you?
No, I guess I really didn't think much about it because I mostly played sports along with them, like basketball, softball, and that kind of stuff. And I really didn't think too much about it. Only one of my youngest brother would play dolls with me, and the rest of them would not. But, you know, I didn't really think too much about it.
So how about school? You said both parents could read. When did you learn to read?
It was before I went to elementary school, and I went to elementary school, I think, when I was 5 years old, and so it must have been like 4 years old when
four
I learned
old.
To read.
Isn't that unusual?
I guess it was. I didn't know. And then I skipped a lot of grades. I really didn't skip them, but what they did was they would give me the work that I was supposed to do, and I finished it so fast they would put me in the next grade. So,
what kind of schools? You were in the South. Were the schools segregated?
Yes.
Tell me about schools in the South.
Yes.
This is before Brown.
The high school, elementary and high school that I went to was called All-Timer Training School as opposed to All-Timer High School, because the high school, the one that was called the high school was for white students. So mm-hmm. they called ours training school, whatever that meant.
Okay, and then what was it like? Did they have science, or did you study science in high school, or what?
Nope. We had the bare minimum, to tell you the truth. We had English and we had math. We had math up through, I would say, maybe the first semester of algebra. That's all the math that we had. And we had some social science, maybe geography, and those kinds of things. But we didn't have any science when I was there, any science at all.
No science in high school, okay.
No.
Tell me about your teachers, who taught the schools?
Most of the teachers there were people who had graduated from the college there in Pine Bluff, and most of them lived in Pine Bluff and came down every day to teach us. And I guess they were pretty competent in their areas. But one thing that I can say about the teachers at that time was that they pushed us. They made us, you know, talk about going to college and, you know, those kinds of things. And I don't think too much of that happens today.
Mm, they're good. You said they skipped you a lot, so did you graduate
that was,
early?
That was in elementary school. Well, I guess I
high
did.
School.
When I graduated, I was 16.
16?
Yes.
Wow. And then, so, but you were still in the segregated school, so you were before?
Yes.
This was 1954, right?
Exactly.
The year of Brown versus Board of Education?
That's right, exactly. Right. I graduated valedictorian in my high school class.
Wow. Tell me, you said, now we talked about Arkansas A&E. Why did you go there? Couldn't you go anywhere? Couldn't you go to any college?
I suppose I could have, but to tell you the truth, that was the only one that I knew about. See, the teachers were from that college, and that was the only one that they talked about. And so I didn't really have any information on all the colleges that were out there, some that are private. AM&N was a state school.
How was college funded? I know state school, so you were in state. So how did you fund your college education with six kids in the class, in the school, in your family?
The first year, I had a small scholarship from my high school. That was all I had. And what I did the first year was I rode the bus over there, took my classes, I rode the bus back. I said 14 miles. If I didn't, mm-hmm. It was 14 miles from mm-hmm. there. Now, and also my older brother, as I said, who came from the Army, he was, you know, an adult, and he had a car, and sometimes I would ride over there with him. Now, at the end of my freshman year, I got a full scholarship, tuition room and board, to the college because of my average. I had a straight A average.
Didn't something happen in your sophomore year? You took chemistry.
Yeah, I did.
Why did you take chemistry?
It's interesting. There were four of us who sort of, I guess, became friends in the freshman year. You know, even before class, before you register, you get students that you become friends with. One of those persons was Lawrence Jr. Well, his father, Lawrence Sr. was the president of the college, and I had gone to high school with Lawrence Jr. at the college high school for 2 years, and then they closed it down, so I went back to Altam and graduated. So I knew Lawrence Jr., and there were two other students. And, you know, the upperclassmen would tell you, don't take this person, don't do this, don't do that. And they kept telling us, you don't want to take chemistry because Dean Wilson is really, you know, whatever. And basically, that's what led us to enroll in chemistry and to become chemistry majors. Now, I know that isn't a good thing to do. You're supposed to have goals and all that, but I didn't know what goals were at that time. So when they said it was hard, we decided that was what we wanted to do.
So what grade did you get in chemistry?
I think I may have been the only one in chemistry who had not had chemistry in high school. And I made a B in chemistry.
Isn't that amazing?
Interestingly enough, B was the highest grade in that class. at midterm, all of us had Fs.
Oh, wow.
But mine was F1. I never will forget that. But I made a B in that class, and that was the highest grade in that class.
So that made you decide to be major in chemistry, or?
Well, we had decided that we were going to major in chemistry when they told us it was hard. We decided when we were freshmen.
Ah, that's interesting. Kids, all right. So what happened as you went on through graduation? What what honors did you receive?
I at the end of that first year, I also got something. It may have been the second year. I got a Rockefeller Scholarship, and that was sort of like a teaching scholarship. Now, a teaching assistant scholarship, because my job was to help with the chemistry classes. During the rest of my time there, I made one other B, and believe it or not, it was in something called Negro History. And I do not believe that I earned that B. The professor told me that I had not lived up to my capability or something like that. And since I've been a teacher, I have always tried to be fair to my students, to give them the grade that they earn. And because I always think about that, because I think I should have earned an A in that course.
So what happened when you graduated? You only had two B's all through college?
Yes.
So what honor did you receive on graduation from college? What year?
Valedictorian, 1968. In May, I was valedictorian. I had a 2.96, I think, average.
Wow. Wasn't that 1958?
58. Our commencement speaker was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Ooh.
And they wrote a piece about him. I think it was in the little magazine called Crisis Magazine. Mm-hmm. My mother had a copy of it, and I don't know what happened to it, but I cannot find a copy of it, because they had his picture and my picture in there.
Oh, let me find it.
I hope you can. Okay. I think it was called Crisis, but it was the NAACP, I think, magazine. But they had his picture and my picture side by side, because I was a valedictorian.
Okay. So what happened to you after college? What did you do?
Well, during college, I had spent most of the summers with my aunt in St. Louis. And at the last summer, the summer between my junior and senior year, I went to Chicago, because that's where I could get a job, and I worked in a candy factory that summer. And so when I finished college, well, let me back up. What I had told them was that I didn't want to teach. And I really didn't understand that was the only thing, basically, that black people could do. Somehow, I didn't understand racism. And so I told them that I didn't want to teach. My professor had me fill out an application to go to Stanford University. And I also filled out an application for a job at Monsanto Chemical Company in St. Louis. I think, yeah, that's what it was. Well, when they got the application, they rushed by FedEx, I think it was, back. I sent a letter. And they rushed the application back, told me they had an opening and wanted me to fill it out and get it right back to them. And I guess between the time that they sent it back to me and I got it back to them, evidently they found out that that was a black college and I was black, and so they called me and told me that they had decided to fill the opening with somebody from inside. And at Stanford, they simply wrote back and told me that they didn't have any money to offer me to go to school. And so during the summer, I stayed with my aunt. At the end of the summer, everybody in my class had a job except me. And I was a valedictorian. And so it must have been around November when I went back to Arkansas all-timer because the principal told my mother that he had a job for me. You see, at that time, in Arkansas, schools were in session during the summer months when they were not chopping the cottons anymore, and the cotton wasn't ready to be picked, and so they went to school in the summer, and then they didn't go back to school until I think it was November, and he told her that he had an opening for me, and so I went back to Arkansas. And it's interesting because the principal was teaching algebra and classes like that in math, and he was not a math person. He was a social science major. But he gave me courses. I was the homeroom teacher for 7B. And B was the worst part of the seventh grade. I tried to teach geography, and I didn't know any more about geography than the students did. I had reading because they had seen reading on my transcript, but the reading that was on my transcript was not how to teach reading. It was reading in a special program for gifted students at college. So I had to teach reading, I had to teach arithmetic and that kind of stuff. And I said, if I said I didn't want to teach, I know I don't want to teach now. And so in the meantime, my professor, my chairman at college, told me about an opportunity to come to Atlanta University. And he knew Dr. Huggins, who was chairman of that department. And so I got a scholarship to come to Atlanta University. And I came to Atlanta University.
Yeah, didn't Sputnik have something to do with this?
Yes. What happened was the NSF put a program in place because of Sputnik, because Sputnik had, the Russians had sent the astronauts up there, and so somehow the NSF thought that they should get on the ball in training scientists, and so they put in these programs. The one that I was in was for high school science teachers. I think they had one for math as well. And in fact, I was in a chemistry one. They had also had one for biology teachers, and I'm pretty sure they had one for math teachers. And at some point, they had a program that was designed to help elementary school teachers, so they could start teaching students in the elementary, teaching science to the students in the elementary school. And that, yes, what it was. It was called NSF Chemistry Teachers Program. And to tell you the truth, I don't know if we want to publish this, but Dr. Huggins told me much later on that he got in trouble because the rule said that you should have been teaching for 3 years, and I had only been teaching less than 1 year. There were two of us in the program who were not eligible according to that rule. He said that they kind of bawled him out about that, but interestingly enough, we were the only two who came back the next year and finished our master's.
Well, didn't something almost stop this from your going for the master's?
No.
Wasn't there something about money?
Well, what happened was I went in on the NSF program, and at the end of the year, I didn't have a scholarship. That the NSF program was just for a year. And so I was about to leave, and Dr. Huggins called me aside, and he really talked to me almost as if he were my father, because I was supposed to be getting married, and I wasn't worried about a master's degree. And he told me that he would make me, I think, a teaching assistant, that he had some money, you know, for me to continue my education. And so that's what happened.
So Dr. Huggins was like a mentor?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Huggins and Dr. McBay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're going to get to Dr. McBay. So what did you do did you get married?
I got married, but I came back to school.
Oh, okay. And so what did you do? When did you get your MS degree? And what kind of research did you do? I think you did research, right?
I got it the next year. That was 1961.
Mm-hmm.
I did my research under Dr. Huggins. It was basically in what we call butadiene chemistry, because that's all Dr. Huggins did. I really didn't want to do that kind of research, but he took me on as his student.
Did you write a thesis for this?
Yes, I did.
And so it's at Atlanta University?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so butadiene chemistry. So you became an organic chemist.
Right.
You like it?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I didn't particularly like butadiene chemistry. In my vita, I think I have the title of it. It was a 1,3 disubstituted something.
Yeah. Do you want a break?
Yeah.
Okay, we can break.
Okay.
Okay, continuing. You had your master's degree, and what did you do after your master's degree?
I went to South Carolina State University. I think it was called South Carolina State College at that time. I went there and taught general chemistry for a year. And during that time, Dr. McBay told Dr. Benjamin E. Mays to back up. Dr. Mays had a convocation at South Carolina State every year. And when he came down there, he told, Dr. McBay had told him that he wanted him to offer me a job at Morehouse. And so he came over there and he told me, and I agreed. And so after the first year, at the end of the first year, I went back to Morehouse in the fall.
Let's back up. Who was Benjamin E. Mays?
Benjamin E. Mays was the then president of Morehouse College. And I thought it was very interesting because when he came to speak at South Carolina State, I didn't go to whatever it was he was speaking at, but he got the president of South Carolina State to drive him over to my house. And he came in, Dr. Mays came in and told me what Dr. McBay had said. And so that's how I got an opportunity to come back to Morehouse.
So Henry McBay, how did he know about you?
Oh, because when I was at Atlanta University, he was teaching classes. He taught the general chemistry for teachers, and he taught some other classes, you know, for me to complete my master's. And he was impressed with my record.
Henry McBay? What's his called name the fame?
Okay. Dr. McBay, mostly he spent most of his life as the chairman of the chemistry department at Morehouse. He got his degree from the University of Chicago, I think, in 1945. So did Dr. Huggins. Dr. Huggins, I think, got his degree from the University of Chicago in 1937, I think. But Dr. McBay was a researcher. He What he wanted me to do when he asked me to come back to Morehouse, he wanted me to teach one class, and that was organic chemistry, and do research in his lab, and that's what I did. Unfortunately, Dr. McBay didn't have the opportunity that I had, if you can call them that, in meaning that he was not able to, you know, do publications as he wanted to, and I really wasn't able to, especially when you work at a black college, you have so many other things to do. If you get a chance to do research, you may not have time to write it up and all of that. I've got a paper now that's ready to go, but it's not ready to go because I have to reformat it. But anyway, Dr. McBay was one of the best known black chemists in the United States. But he was mostly known for turning out PhDs in chemistry.
Did you like college teaching? I mean, let's back up to South Carolina State. Do you like it better than high school?
Yes, I did. I told you before that when I was in the high school, actually I was in high school, they had a 6-6 program. So the seventh grade that I was teaching was in the high school. And I told you, I said, when I get out, Lord, if I ever get out of here, you know. Well, when I went to college, it was different because basically I said, you teach what you have to teach and they should get it. You can try to help them and all of that, but if they don't get it, you give them F and, you know, they have to repeat it. So I began to like teaching at South Carolina State. Although at South Carolina State, the course that I had was a general chemistry course, which included both majors and non-majors, and I was unhappy about that because you couldn't do what I thought I should do for majors, whatever I did was too much for non-majors. I really complained about that. But to answer your question, I did begin to like teaching.
At South Carolina State is black college?
Yeah, it's a black college.
Who were the on the faculty then here?
I remember that there was a man named Mr. Green, and there was a man, an organic chemist named Dr. Chigbo. I don't even know how to spell
it. White or black?
Black.
They're all black. Okay.
And there was one other fellow, I can't remember his name. He came there at the same time I came there.
Okay. So you're now back at Atlanta U,
mm-hmm.
Doing research, and
mm-hmm.
you're happy as a clam?
Oh, yes. I was teaching organic chemistry, too, and I really love that. I love teaching organic chemistry. Because, first of all, I learned a whole lot of organic chemistry, you know, while I was teaching it. But Dr. McBay had some interesting research going on, and I love that, too. I love research. And so I was really happy. But what happened was I said to myself, if I'm going to stay in this teaching business, I've got to go back to school and get a doctorate. And so after 2 years, I quit my job at Morehouse, and I had applied and gotten accepted to the University of Chicago and to Howard. I quit my job at Morehouse, and there was an assistant to Dr. Mays there, and I think he was from Arkansas, but he sort of knew me, and he wanted me to get my resignation back and apply for a leave. And I said, no. I said, if I'm going to get my degree, I have to have as much time as needed. And I don't want y'all calling me, telling me my leave is over, you know, before I get it. So I quit my job and went back to school.
Which school did you choose? You said
the University of Chicago.
And why did you choose Chicago over Howard?
Well, actually, I had a lot of applications, and I got the application from Howard, the application from the University of Chicago, back more quickly than I got the others, but I had a lot of them, and so I filled those two out first, and you know how it is. I said, well, I'll work on some of the others later on. But as soon as I sent my application then, I got a reply from both of those institutions, and they both offered me a teaching assistantship. And there were probably two things which made me want to go to the University of Chicago. First of all, Dr. McBay and Dr. Huggins were graduates of there, of the University of Chicago, and I heard so much about their, their program. And also because the University of Chicago offered me so much more in assistantship than Howard University did.
So here you are, a woman from the South. How did you transition to Chicago life? Let's start with life first and then school.
Well, I really didn't have too much life because I was studying, you know, most of the time that I was there. So I didn't have too, you see, I had four brothers who were in Chicago, and I had been to Chicago before, so I knew a little bit about it. And I really didn't have, as I said, I didn't have too much time for things outside of school. So I didn't have any problem transitioning from the South to Chicago, at least in terms of, you know.
Outside. What about the, you were in an all-white school. How did you manage there?
Yeah. I tell people this, and it's really true. I guess I was so naive that I didn't know that I, as a black woman, I was not supposed to get a PhD in chemistry. I really didn't know. And when I went there, there was one other lady in the program. She was part-time. She worked at Roosevelt University, and she was coming, were taking classes part-time. And there was a fellow who was working in the Cancer Institute, and he was taking classes part-time. I was full-time. I was the only black full-time person in the organic area of organic chemistry. I'm trying to remember whether Billy Joe came the second year. He may have come the first year. Billy Joe transferred from Berkeley to Chicago, and he and I used to eat our lunch together. We'd bring our lunch and all of that. Billy Joe was a Morris Brown graduate, and I knew him when I was working at Morehouse.
Well, how did you... you said you got a funding from Chicago, teaching assistantship?
Yes.
And was this sufficient? What about your husband at the time? Where was he?
He was in school at the Chicago Conservatory of Music. He worked on his master's, and he got his master's at the Chicago Conservatory of Music.
Is he a musician?
Actually, he taught music. He was teaching music, and when he came out, and went back to teaching high school. He's a band director. That's what he really was.
What about teaching people or mentors at the school? Other students? Did you have any mentors at the school?
No. That was I had to make it on my own, and interestingly enough, there were no mentors, there wasn't anything there. And the first year that I was there, because I had taught organic chemistry for 2 years, and because when you teach courses, you really, really learn them. So I knew a lot about mechanism, you know, a lot about organic chemistry. And I would always, you know, try to help other people out. The first course that I took there, I made a C in it. And for the life of me, I cannot tell you why I made a C in it. And the students who I helped, you know, made B's and whatever. And that's an example, I think. I really think that at the University of Chicago, even though they had black people in the department, I don't think they had but one black female ahead of me, and her name was Aretha King. You know Aretha, don't you? She got her degree before I did, and she was the first black female. And so, but I don't know. I guess coming from a small town where I came from, either I ignored racism, I don't know what it was, but I just didn't think about it, you know, about racism. But after the first year, I decided, no, I'm not going to help anybody, because I'm going to do my best. I'm going to do what I have to do and let them worry about it, because, you know, at most schools, students get together, they get old tests and all of that. There was one lady there, a white lady, in the program who was married to a black man. I don't think they knew that. And whenever she got some information, she would share it, you know, with me and the other two, the other lady and the man who were part-time.
But that was Sarah Woods and Loretta Smith-Jones?
You got those names. Loretta was the white lady. Yeah. Sarah Woods was a black lady from Roosevelt, and I don't remember the fellow's name who was at the Cancer Institute. He was part-time, too.
So those were your study buddies?
Well, actually, we really didn't study because Sarah was part-time, so she only came to take this one class in organic chemistry. The fella was only part-time, so he came to take this one course in organic chemistry. And Loretta Jones, you know, she lived out somewhere, so she came to take the course. I didn't have anybody to study with, but that didn't bother me because I basically had been doing that all my life. So, but what I'm trying to say is, when Loretta was able to get past tests, you know, of the teacher, and we were in a class, and she was able to get past tests from her white friends, then she would make sure that we had access to them.
Tell me about your research. And that you did it for your PhD.
Okay. It's really kind of interesting. What I did was, it was foreign chemistry, but it was organic. Let me back up. My project involved the synthesis of a lot of fluorine compounds, and then we did a study on the F-19 NMR. And basically what we did was to... Okay. The people who were doing substituent effect chemistry in organic chemistry had been doing it basically using ester analysis, ester hydrolysis, I should say. And so my professor wanted to look at the effect of substituents on the F-19 NMR chemical shift. And so I had to make all these compounds, and then I had to do an analysis.
Who was your professor?
Leon Stock. Leon M. Stock.
What's his background?
He finished Purdue under H.C. Brown. You know, Brown, who was the boron chemist. Yeah. And he had not really been at Chicago that long.
And so who chose, when you were looking for a thesis advisor, how did you select?
Actually, this is what happened, and it was really kind of ironic. The first year I was at Chicago, at the end of the year, they made us take the prelims, what they called them. Now, I had decided that I didn't want to take the prelims, and I had said to my advisor that I didn't want to take the prelims. What happened was somehow they decided that everybody had to take them. It was what I felt was that I wanted to learn chemistry the way the people who wrote the textbooks learned it. So I wasn't in any hurry. And so I was taking a course called Synthetic Organic Chemistry, laboratory course. And I was in there, I was working on the stuff. We had to do experiments from the literature. And most times I would go through the experiment and I would work out the bugs, and the students would come in. I would, oh, you can't do this, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. And I learned later that they were studying for the prelims while I was down there working out the bugs in the laboratory. Make a long story short, I had to take them, and I had not studied. And I failed it. But let me tell you what happened, really what happened. That first of all, that was the first time I had ever failed anything in my life. And I was so upset. I went to the man in the office. He was some kind of administrator. And he just jumped all over me. We let y'all come in here, and y'all don't do anything. And y'all, yes, he did. And so I left. And what I did was I went to my advisor. My advisor was a German professor. And I told him, I said, you know, I know that I didn't pass the exam, but I don't understand how I did so poorly according to this man. I can't think of his name. And my advisor said, you didn't. He said, you had the second highest score in the group. Now, let me just tell you something. I had never studied. Evidently, everything that I put on my paper was right, but I was slow, and so I didn't finish the test. He said, no, you didn't. He said, you had the second highest score. And so when I went home, I felt much better. The black guy who took the test was really upset when he went home because I think his wife called me, and I told her, I said, well, he told me the same thing, but I went to my advisor, and my advisor said I didn't do too bad, you know. But that was the kind of thing that happened. Now, there were three ways they could treat you after the test. If you passed the test, you could go on and get a research advisor, and if he or she selected you, then you could do your research starting that summer. If you failed the test, they could recommend that you take it over when it was offered again. Or the third thing they could do, if you fail the test, they could recommend that you should not take it over. That's what they recommended for me. That's what they recommended for this black guy. Now, so anyway, to make a long story short, I spent the whole summer in Chicago looking for a job because I just, you know, I was tired of that. And I went to this one place, I'll tell you this first. There was a black guy who had just started working in this employment firm, and he came out to my house and told me how they were discriminating against me and all of that. But what he did was, and I won't go into any detail, but I went to this one company, and there was a lady who interviewed me, a white lady. And she said to me, she said, listen, I told her that I had failed a test. I mean, I was really upset. I had never failed a test in my life. She said, let me tell you something. She had gotten her degree from the University of Chicago. And she told me, she said, when I got my degree, all I wanted was one job. And she said, it took her a long time to find it. She said, and when you get your degree, it's going to be harder for you to find. That's when I really began to realize that women weren't supposed to be in chemistry. And she said, I would love to give you this job. She said, but I would be doing you a disservice. She said, I want you to study and go back to the university and take that test over again. Also, she probably knew that almost everybody failed the test in the first place because I found it out later. But anyway, so I stopped looking for a job. In the meantime, while I was looking, this man told me that the University of Chicago had told them that I was, they had given me such a ringing endorsement for a job. Anyway, so I stopped. I went home, and I read a book that was by Jack Hine. We called it the Bible of Physical Organic Chemistry, and I worked every problem at the end of every chapter except the last chapter, because what happened was I got a call from the University of Chicago to come up there and see the same old man who had really told me off. And he told me that he had a job offer, I think it was in Gary, Indiana, and that Dr. Stock had needed somebody. He wanted to hire somebody to work in his lab. And so he said I could do one or the other. Anyway, I think I went to Gary, but I went to see Dr. Stock, and Dr. Stock told me all about if I worked for him, that I had to. This I have to tell you this because you would be amazed at what happened. And he told me, he said, if you work for me, I expect you to work 8 hours per day. And he told me all of that stuff. And I'm standing there and said, well, if I'm going to work for him, what does he think I intend to do? What I learned later was that the students who got a chance to work that summer before they went to take the test over really didn't work. They were working on the test. But I didn't know that. I expect to work. And so what happened was he gave me a procedure that he wanted me to make this compound. And the Lord is good, I'm going to tell you. The procedure was in a French paper. Now, I had 3 years of German, but I had not had any French. And I said to myself, okay. So what I did was I went to the bookstore and got a French dictionary. And I went home and I translated it. And that was like on a Friday. So when I went back that Monday, I was ready to do the experiment. And I set it up under the hood. I had all kinds of It was a diazotization, but you had to use nitric oxide, so you had to have connect it to a cylinder, and I had all kinds of safety stuff. I had it all set up, and a couple of guys in his lab came down. Oh, well, you got all that stuff? They were, you know, just making fun of it. I didn't say anything. So anyway, I put the stuff in there. I ran the experiment, and the last part of it was to decompose the diazonium salt. That would put the fluorine on the anthracene. That was one I was doing, and that the 9-fluoroanthracene was the apparent molecule. And so when I got it out and dried it and all that, Dr. Stock had told me that I could take it up on the second floor and use their setup. And so I went up there. Oh, there were two white guys who worked in that lab. They were teasing me.
NMR?
No. When you look at it,
a microscope?
Not a microscope. One of these little, what you call them? Anyway, I said, no. Why did I need that? I'm gonna have so much stuff. I don't have to look at it through that. I can see it. What I didn't know at the time that man had put everybody in his group on that experiment. And he had even hired people in the summer to work on it. And nobody had made that compound. And that was why they were saying, did I need a, I don't know why, I can't think of it. Anyway, I set it all up, and I went down there. I went down there to talk to the administrator, because I had to fill out some papers. I wasn't in school, but technically they had put me, I had to be a research assistant. And so all of a sudden, Dr. Stock came by the office down there. He was going down the hall, and he came in and he said, oh, we got lots of 9-fluoroanthracene, lots of 9-fluoroanthracene. And I wasn't understanding why they were all so excited about it. Because what happened was I had made a whole lot of the stuff on the first try. And the people who had been doing it in the past had maybe made a little bit they could barely see. Oh, he was so excited. But anyway, that's how I got into get to work for him. Because when he would come down there every day, I would have 2 or 3 setups going. That's what we did at Clark Atlanta University. And I would, I'd have 2 or 3, and he'd say, what you got going there? I would tell him. Anyway, after a few weeks, he told me, he said, well, you just go on somewhere and study, because I can't keep up with you. I've run out of idea, whatever he said. And so then I went to study. But he had told me I wasn't supposed to be studying. And so I took the exam, and I am pretty sure that I made the high score on that exam. Nobody would ever tell me that, because there was only one problem, a B part of a problem, there was only one I couldn't figure out the structure, and nobody else in that group with me could figure it out, so I know we all missed that one. I didn't miss anything else. And so Dr. Stock told me that, first of all, there was, what was this man's name? He went to school with Dr. McBay, and I tried to get a job from him. See, they wouldn't give me a job, they wouldn't give this other black fella a job, because they had said we were not supposed to take it over. If they had said we were supposed to take it over, that meant then that they would give us work to do while we, waited for it. Anyway, so I can't can't think of this man's name. He passed me in the hallway. That was a good job. That was a good job.
That wasn't Tom Cole.
No, no, no.
Okay.
This was a professor.
Okay.
Because I had gone to him and asked him if he would let me work that time, and he didn't. I can't think of his name. Anyway, then Dr. there was a written part of it. The written part was probably 5 hours, and then there was an oral part. And before we got to the oral part, Dr. Stock had told me, I went in there to see him about something. He said, "You know, I have appointed you to work for me." And I said, "Okay." And I said to myself, "Well, you don't know whether I want to work for you or not." But I took the oral part and all of that. To tell you the truth, I really didn't have any problems after that. But there was an Italian lady who worked in the chemistry library, and that lady told me the coffee pot, I was down in the basement, the coffee was in the chemical stock room, and they would come down there every day and get coffee. And she would come by, she said, "You look so down, so depressed and all this." She said, "Let me tell you one thing." She said, You will not have to worry when you take this test and pass it. See, I understand, according to what I was told later on, but I didn't have anybody to speak up for me in the discussion that they had after the test. So my score didn't mean anything too much. The girl, this white girl, Loretta made almost nothing, and she passed it. And she was furious. She was really furious. But anyway, so that's how I got to work with Dr. Stock, because the stuff that I had done that summer really put me...
This ran out of film.
Oh.
Keep going.
Oh. Really had put me really on par with the other students who passed the test and were doing their research. And so that's how, you know, I could have said, "Well, no, I'm going to talk to some other people." But I enjoyed what I was doing. And so I continued. And that was really a big, big break for me. And then Dr. Stock had ordered a brand new fluorine 19 NMR. And when it was really a H1 and F19.
Tell me about that.
When it came in,
you're pioneering that.
Didn't anybody know how to operate it but me? And I shouldn't say this, don't put this in your book. But sometimes when I didn't want anybody to use it, I go in there and I would leave it on fluorine. And then they would come in there and say, "Gloria, are you finished with the NMR? Can you switch it to H1? Because nobody could use it but me. And there were people from the Cancer Research Center sending stuff over there for me to look at the fluorine NMR. So that some metabolites. I can't think of the man who was over it. But I was the expert in fluorine 19 NMR there.
Yeah, you were your pioneer fluorine NMR. I mean, who else was doing fluorine 19? Tell me what year this is.
I went there in 1964. I started my research in 1965. And I got my degree in 1968, so it was that period. I can tell you who were doing it. There was Sly, I believe was his name, out in Pennsylvania.
Sly?
And I think his name was Sly.
Okay.
I hope
I'll find it.
It's probably in my dissertation, because Dewar was the other one, and Dewar was in Texas. And one reason I had to convince my advisor that I was right in saying something wrong, seeing something I said in there that Duell had said something, and basically I said he was wrong. He was wrong. And my advisor didn't want to put that in there until I convinced him that I knew what I was talking about. So
how did you learn to run this fluorine 19 NMR, which is brand new?
Well, in the course, I told you I was in the course and I was doing all the synthetic stuff and not studying for my test. In that course, we had to learn instrumentation, and one of them was the NMR. And Tom Cole taught me. We were in smaller groups. I think there were four or five students in a group. And when my group went to him, Tom Cole was the teaching assistant for my group. And I looked at him. Here he was. He sat down to this was the proton NMR. And he was turning budgets. He was doing every kind of thing. I said, wow. You know, it was so impressive. And, he'd do this, he would do that, and all that. And he taught us how to run the proton NMR. And so when we got the proton fluorine NMR, it was a matter of learning how to change it from the proton to fluorine, and learning the difference between fluorine and proton. I did that on my own. So
you did this on your own?
I didn't have anybody there to teach me. Sure did.
Wow.
I did the same thing at Lockheed about FTIR.
So you wasn't there something unusual about you doing your research before your thesis?
Well, what happened was when I was working for Dr. Stock, I was working as an employee, but they had to put me down as a student. Because I know now, I didn't know then, because he had a grant. And so, you know, they had to put me down as a student. And they enrolled me for whatever the maximum number of classes there was. But I really was not enrolled in school, technically. But that work that I did became the first part of my dissertation. And when I went in to work for him, I was just an employee.
Wasn't there a publication?
Well, we had...
Before your thesis?
Oh, yeah, sure. One day...
Is that usual?
I don't think it is usual. We were... This publication that we did it over the weekend. He really wrote it, but I had to supply the data and the explanation. What happened was, when I looked at the bridgehead F19 chemical shift, and when you look at that one, I think I had bicyclooctane, I had adamantane, and I may have had bicycloheptane. If I didn't have it, I must have gotten the information from somewhere else. And when we looked at them, what we found was they were, we believe that the order of the chemical shift was in the reverse of what we thought it would be. And so Dr. Stott said we should write a communications on that. And we did, and basically what we said was that it confirmed the notion that carbon at the bridgehead and the fluorine were basically had some double double bond character in that bond, and that was why it was that way. And it's, I don't know, I followed it for a while after I came here. I'm not sure anybody has ever refuted that, but I'm not sure because I didn't follow it all the way up to now. But people were writing papers and quoting us.
Ooh, citations.
Okay. So you got your PhD. Who was on your your committee? Do you have any problems?
On the first committee, I don't remember who was on it because that was the one that I failed. You know, I didn't know anybody. They didn't speak up for me, anything. That's why, even though I made the second highest, if I didn't make the second highest score, the man had told me that I did. Now, on the second go-around, Dr. Stock was now on there because he had already claimed me as his student. Dr. Eaton and was it Dr. Eaton? It may not have been Dr. Wang, and Dr. Wang did not come because he knew that they had done me wrong, somebody said. But they didn't give me any problem. In fact, I was really ready for them. One of the guys who worked upstairs in Tom's Cole group, he would come down there and ask me questions and all. I was really ready, and they didn't ask me anything. I was so disappointed when I left out of there. So obviously, you know, I passed it with flying colors. The lady had told me there was nothing. She told me that I could make zero on that test, and I would pass because she said they didn't know you. And after I had gone and done that research, she said I didn't have to do anything after that.
So that's why you got your PhD, with all your good research.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. What happened in your early career, or do you want to play?
No. I have to tell you about my dissertation because.
Yeah. Tell me some more.
When I was at Clark, at Atlanta University, well, at Chicago, what the people would do is they would finish their research, and then they would come in every day and they would write on it. And they read the paper first, get a cup of coffee, they sit down and read the paper. And all the time that I was doing research, I would have two or three things going at one time. And I worked at night at least the first year. And my colleagues in my group did not work at night, and most of the other students didn't work at night. But that was normal for AU, and I was coming out of AU. And so, anyway, when I wrote the stuff in my lab book, I wrote the procedures exactly as it should be written in a thesis, because I knew that that was how you're supposed to do it. And so, basically, when I finished doing my research in the laboratory, I had done my dissertation. And when I brought my dissertation up there was one guy in there. His name was Ron Gold. He almost had a fit because he thought he was the smartest person in that group, in the whole group of organic chemistry students. And when I brought it up there, because I worked on it at night at home, I came to the lab, and worked on, did my, and when I finished my lab work, I had finished my dissertation. And I turned it in, and my professor, I don't know, I think there were probably two things wrong with it. One, you have to read, when I write, you have to read it A, B, C, D, 1, 2, you know, you can't read A and then skip over here to D or whatever. And also, I was questioning some work which was done by Dewar. And he said basically that I couldn't say that and blah, blah, blah. And so what happened was, now the rest of my dissertation was all right. It was the introduction that was the problem. Not the introduction,
Need for new work.
No, the introduction.
I got it, man. Keep going.
I know we had the experimental, that was fine.
Introduction?
Yeah.
Need for new research?
No. There's a part in there. It's really the analysis, but that's not what you call it. You know, what I did was...
Results?
That's the part. That's the part that I had trouble with. And so when he read it, he gave it back to me. The rest of it was okay, but he had questions about the results and discussion. And you know what happened? I had to go into his office almost every day and teach him that stuff. And so...
Yeah, the results were about the F-19 chemical shifts.
Yeah, see, I made the compounds, and then I ran the NMR, and then I had to calculate the chemical shifts. And whatever you see in there, that stuff that I put in there, is, as far as I know, is still used today. SCS, I think it was. That they would not, we did not have that before. Maybe I hadn't thought about this a long time. This one, substituent chemical shift, that I coined that. And as far as I know, they still use it today. But anyway, what happened was I put the chemical shifts in there, and I had to explain, you know, why they were what they were. And he didn't understand it. And so I went in there every day. He would go to the board and he would ask a question. I had answers for everything that he had. And then one day he said, you know, I think we finally got the hang of this. And I'm saying to myself, I've already had the hang of it. And then he corrected himself. He said, no. He said, I guess it was me. I didn't understand. He really said that. I will never forget that. And so I taught him, and after I started going in there and telling him, he sat right with his desk. He had my dissertation spread out, and he wrote the papers right out of there. I didn't write them, you know, I didn't physically write them. I had written it there. All he did was transfer it into the format, and he published the paper. I said, he must have said, I mean, maybe this nigga has something going on here. And so, anyway, when I went to my oral, you have an oral after you finish your stuff, and to tell you the truth, when I went to that oral, I was not scared at all. Because I knew that I knew more about my work than anybody else in there, and that included my professor, and he was the closest one. And that's when Eden was on that committee. Eden Stock, and I've forgotten who the other person was. And what happened was Eden was Tom Cole's advisor. Mm-hmm. But anyway, there was one question that Stock, who was my advisor, had asked me. It was about the same kind of stuff that we talked about, the paper that we had published before. He had asked me, how could you get evidence to support that? And I told him, we would have to do F-19 NMR, which made not F-19 NMR, FTIR, bond stretching. That's mm-hmm. And so when we got to the oil, they asked questions. I'd go up there and I would explain. And Ms. Stock said, and I was talking about this same thing that we had published in that paper. I was explaining what we said about it. And so Stock said, he said, well, how can we get evidence on this? Now, Eden was the instrumental person. And Eden said, infrared spectroscopy. I wanted to die because I had already told him that. Anyway, Eden said at the end of my oral, he said that I had come to Chicago as a frightened young lady, and I was going out looking like what he called me. Anyway, he was so pleased, you know, how I had done this. Anyway, that's it.
Yeah, you were 30, not even 30 years old yet. I'm not supposed to do that. Tell me, we've been talking about Tom Cole. Mm-hmm. Tell me about him and what he was doing for you and subsequent.
Tom was working for Eden and Phil Eden, and Tom made, I don't know whether you've heard of cubane. That's the molecule that looks just like a cube. Mm-hmm. But Tom Cole made, he was the first person to make that compound for Eden. And Tom was there when I got there. And we didn't really see too much of each other because he was in his lab and I was in my lab. And you know, he was married, so I was married too, so you know, we left and went home. But there was one thing, and I don't want you to write this in there because I never want Tom to think I feel this way, but I always felt that if Tom Cole had told me about the prelims, I would have been much better off. First of all, everybody in my group, I have to learn later on, everybody in the group that I was in had failed the prelim. Everybody in most of the groups had failed the prelims. But I think most of those people got the recommendation that you should take it over. I don't know what Tom Cole got because I wasn't there. But if he had just kind of warned me about that, I wouldn't have been so down, you know, so depressed. I mean, here I am failing. Even though the man told me that I had, you know, I had the second highest average, I mean, I had never failed anything. That's the only thing that I wish he had done. Now, when he got ready to graduate, I begged him to come to the AU Center, and he did. He came, and then he became the chairman of the chemistry department, and when I came here, he was the chairman of the chemistry department, and we worked well together with the interdisciplinary interinstitutional committees and all that, but then he became a vice president and the president, and he went off into administration. And when I got my first NMR, when I got my FT NMR, I was telling him, I said, you got to come over here and see this FT NMR. He said, Gloria, you know, I don't remember any of that stuff anymore. And I said, golly, this is the man who was at Chicago I was so impressed with.
So what happened to you after your PhD? What were your job prospects? What did you do?
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't look for any jobs, and I'll tell you why. First of all, when I was finishing up my dissertation, Martin Luther King got killed in Memphis. And it was at that point that I decided that I was going to come to a black college. I didn't make any difference which one. And that was going to be my offer instead of March, and that would be my offer in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. McVeigh came to Chicago, and I didn't know which black college I would be, I would be going to, but I wanted to go to a black college and to allow the students to have the opportunity to get the kind of education that I had gotten, because I felt, coming from where I came from, that it was like it was almost impossible for me to get the kind of training that I had gotten. Like I used to tell them when I was on the CPB board, I used to tell them that I squeezed through the wire mesh fence. Anyway, and so I didn't know where I was going, but that spring, the ACS had its meeting in Chicago, and Dr. McVeigh came, and there was another fella who, at the time I was a student at AU, this man had just come out of Pennsylvania State as an organic chemist, and he was teaching at AU. His name was Paul Groves. And so Dr. Groves and Dr. McVeigh came over to the University of Chicago to visit me. And Dr. McVeigh told me that there was an opening at Morris Brown. He said, we don't have an opening at Morehouse. You remember I told you I quit the job, so I didn't go on leave. And he said, we don't have an opening at Morehouse, but there is an opening at Morris Brown. And he was very concerned because the students at Morehouse would run over here and take chemistry, water downs, and all that. And they didn't want to go to Clark because Dr. Spriggs was there, and they wouldn't get water down stuff. So he wanted me to come here. And he told me Dr. Groves wanted this job. And he kind of hurried ahead of him and told me that I applied for it, came down here. This building, the science building was new that fall. And I mean, that's how I got here.
So, and you got the job.
Mm-hmm.
But you, not only did you get the job, what other job did you get?
Well, I got the job here, and well, first of all, I had a lot of offers from other places. Some universities would call me up. One university called me. What was the name of that university? And they wanted me to come there because I was a fluorine 19 chemist. And they said, I said, well, I'm happy where I am. I said, would you please tell me how you got my name? She said, well, we were reviewing your papers in whatever journal they were in, and we called the University of Chicago to find out where you were. What was that? I think that college's name was Lehigh University. I think that was it. But anyway, I had lots of offers. I even had lots of offers to go to schools in the center. But I stayed at Morris Brown mainly because of the education philosophy at Morris Brown, in that Morris Brown takes in some of the brightest students there are, but at the same time, Morris Brown allows students who are not in the upper echelon to come in here. And I firmly believe that it's not the input, but it is the output that determines how good a school is. And so I have had lots of students who graduated, who went on to medical school, dental school, graduate school, and all that. At one time, I don't know what years it was, but although we didn't have a lot of graduates, 100% of our graduates went to graduate school.
Didn't you have another job at Morris Brown other than being an organic professor?
Well, in 84, I let them talk me into becoming dean of the college. Mm. I did that until 89. I was dean of the college for almost 5 years. I didn't like that at all, but...
Weren't you also chair of the department?
Oh, I came in as chair.
Yeah.
I came in as chair of the chemistry department.
Isn't that not usual? Is that usual?
Oh, I guess it's not. I came in and I started, even before I left Chicago, I asked Dr. Stock, I said, I know with this college where I'm going to, they need instruments and, you know, they need everything. And he told me to write a letter to NSF on University of Chicago stationery and tell them that. I did, but that didn't do any good because the NSF is one of the most highly racist agencies, I should say, in Washington. But anyway, I came in, I started writing proposals and whatever, and the second year I had lots of stuff. Lots of equipment. I had an NMR and all that stuff.
You got that from other places other than NSF.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you get an NSF grant though? Wasn't there NSF?
Yeah. I got a research grant from NSF, but I need to tell you what happened because when I wrote a proposal to NSF, and this was the proposal that was to continue my research in F-19 NMR. And obviously, in order to do that kind of work, you have to make the compounds, you have to collect the data, and then you have to do the analysis. Well, I wrote it to NSF, and interestingly enough, the NSF called Stock at Chicago to ask him if I could do the work. Because he called me and told me he was laughing. And so anyway, but they didn't give me the money. They held it over for a year. And that the next year they had a minority grant. So what they did, now I wrote a grant to them in the mainstream. They didn't have the minority stuff. The next year they had, I guess they knew it was coming up. The next year they had a minority grant program. So they took the money out of the minority grant program and funded me in mainstream. And that killed, I was never able to get any more grants because they would always tell me I couldn't get any minority money then because I had been funded in mainstream. And they told me that. And the first year, it was a 3-year grant. And so in the second year, you should apply, you know, for another grant, and I did, and they did not give me the grant. They did not tell me anything why. And I called. And finally, the program officer, I don't think he intended to answer the phone, but they didn't have call waiting, not call waiting, what is it?
Call ID.
They didn't have that. And so he answered the phone one day, and I asked him, I said, you know, I don't understand why I did not get a grant. And he told me, he said, you know what? He said, I don't understand it either. He said, because what we do is, if we're not going to fund the research, you know, we're not going to continue, we give a phase-out grant. They didn't even do that. And Tom Cole told me he met somebody in Florida one time, and they said that they didn't recommend that I get the grant because I had not published anything. Now, that was less than a year and a half into the grant. You cannot do it. That's why I stopped doing F-19 anymore. Well, I kept doing it. But because I said, okay, I'm at a black college. If I can do anything, I can do synthetic work. Mm-hmm. And so I focused my attention on the synthetic work. And I did some fluorine synthetic work, but I didn't do, and I used F-19 NMR to help identify compounds and all of that, but I got out of the business of trying to do the physical organic part of it simply because I said, even if I get enough data and analyze it and it makes sense, if I present a paper, I'm going to have a problem with it. And so I just gave it up. Right now, I have data related to the stuff that we did, that first paper that we wrote.
You did do some postdoctoral research, though.
At Georgia Tech.
Georgia Tech. Tell me about that.
Well, I went on a NSF postdoctoral research grant in the summer. I finished in December of get it right in a minute. I finished in December of 69. I came to Morris Brown in September, mm-hmm. but I had finished all my work. I just went back to graduate in December because I didn't get my stuff in time to March in the summer. Well, in the spring, in the summer, I went to Georgia Tech. And I really didn't realize at the time that Georgia Tech really didn't like to having too many females in the institution, really. I found out later, I always get in these situations, I always found out later that they had only been allowing women to come there a few years earlier. But anyway, when I went out there and I met the person, Dr. Leota, and I told him who I was and that I was there because I had an NSF grant. Now, NSF had really told him that I was coming and all that. And so he said, oh, you're that Anderson. And I didn't know what he was talking about. What he was talking about was I was that Anderson who had done those publications. And so he told me that he was trying to get into physical organic chemistry. But basically what he was doing was hydrolysis of esters. He wasn't trying to do any F-19 NMR. And he had a project, which he told me about it. And so I said, okay. And so I went to work on the project, and it involved gas chromatography. And so I worked on it, and I finally came to the realization that it was not doing what he thought it would do. That instead of what he thought it would do, it was throwing off benzoic acid. And so I told him that, and he had this person who was a graduate student who was really about to graduate, and he was standing there, and you know, like he didn't even pay me any attention. Okay, so I'm a great believer in doing library research. So I went to the library, I stopped doing stuff in the lab. And lo and behold, way, way, way back in the journal literature, I found two or three papers where these people, they weren't doing the same thing that I was doing, but what happened was they got benzoic acid. I was so happy. So I went home and I wrote it up. We didn't have computers, you know, that kind of stuff. I wrote it all up. And then I sat in the library, chemistry library at Georgia Tech, for a week waiting on him to come in because his office was next to the library. And so finally he came in. I didn't know that he had the flu. And I got up right in behind him. I went in his office. I said, "Dr. Leota," I said, "the problem is solved." And I threw it on his desk, including the German papers. He looked at it. He said, "Well," he said, "could you explain it to me?" I said, I don't read German." So once again, I went to the board. Now, when I was doing my dissertation, my professor went to the board. But I went to the board this time and explained what happened and what was happening with whatever he wanted done. And so when I finished, he said, "You know what? That was a beautiful piece of library and literature research that you did." And I didn't say anything nasty to him, but I said to myself, "I've got a degree from the University of Chicago. I'm supposed to be able to do that kind of work." He had a degree from the University of Maryland. And so, anyway, make a long story short, I didn't really get too far with the project because I had wasted all that time doing the wrong thing. But I did a seminar out there, and after the seminar, he was like he was my dad. He was so proud of me. And after the seminar, he told me, "If I had the money, I would hire you." I said to myself, "Yeah, right." I didn't want to go there anyway. He hired that same fella who I would not have hired, that man, Ed Morris Brown. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's when I did my doctoral work.
You talked about National Science Foundation. Do you know their track record for research grants for HBCUs?
No, I really don't know it in terms of real data. I used to know it. After they started that minority grant, it became, you know, like better. But still, they were just like most of the other granting agencies. There were schools that they decided were worth their money, you know, like Morehouse, Spelman, Tuskegee, from those schools. So I couldn't, well, they told me I couldn't get a grant because I had been in mainstream. And I talked to everybody, I went to meetings, I did everything, but I could never get a grant. And then what they did was they started off a Women in Science program. And that was right around the time when I was coming out of academic affairs as a dean. I said, okay, this is supposed to help women get back into science, right? I called them up and told them I had been a dean and blah, 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 but I wanted to get back into science. Am I qualified? And they told me yes. I put together a proposal and everything, and then I sent it up there. They called and told me that I was not qualified for that program. And the reason they said I wasn't qualified was that in 1984, I had gone out to the Air Force Rocket Lab in California and had done research. And I said, you mean to tell me that these people are penalizing me for I got the opportunity. Every opportunity that I had to, it wasn't like I could plan anything. I got that opportunity. I was at Lockheed in 81 or something. But that's why they couldn't give it to me, because I had already been out there in 84. And this was like, this I think was in the 1990. But I know that I can't give you the data, but I used to read a lot of proposals for the NSF. And one time I was there, and we were just talking. I was talking to the program officer who was over whatever program I was reading for. And I told him, I said, this was a white program officer. I said, the National Science Foundation is one of the most racist agencies there is. And you know what? He agreed with me. But I used to keep up with, the amount of grants that were received by black colleges, but I don't remember anymore. But I know it's much less than what it should be.
You did manage to get some research funding from what other, from corporations or what?
Mm-mm. Most of my research I paid for out of my credit card.
You self-funding your own research?
Most of it, yes. I got a grant from NIH. When NIH started the Minority Institution Biomedical Science something proposal, that was when Jerry Woods, you remember Jerry Woods? She was responsible for putting that program in place at NIH. Now, she was a biologist, she wasn't a chemist. And the center went, all the schools in the center went together and put in an AU Center proposal. And they were begging almost everybody to put in a proposal. And so I got some money from that proposal the first time. And then, as time went on, couldn't get any more money. And I think part of it was because, in that grant, the biologists, or the chemists for that matter, but there weren't too many chemists in there, the biologists could get people for replacement, and they got bigger and bigger and bigger. And for the most part, I think we ended up, all the physical science people got cut out of that one. And that was the most money that I got through a grant. And then I finally decided, I tried a few other times to write institutional grants for Morris Brown, and I won't even try to go into all the hassle that they put me through. But it became clear to me that if I was at Morris Brown College, a college which did not have any history of research in chemistry or biology like that, that nobody was going to give me any money for research. they would send me letters back saying that, basically saying that my credentials were nice, but they weren't going to give me any money. And I don't believe it was because I couldn't write proposals. Because when I came to Marsh Bound, I learned how to write proposals. And whenever I wrote the TRIO program proposals, they got funded. But that was not science research. And so I decided, well, I'm going to do research no matter what. And so I paid students to work for me, paid them in the summer. I paid students to do melting points. I paid students to work as research assistants. I paid them out of my pocket. And I charged stuff on my credit card. And even today, I don't know how much I owe the patent lawyers, but I have paid for all of those patent stuff myself.
You did some research on antiviral drugs?
That's what I've been working on since I came here. And I probably have 300 or 400 compounds over there in the lab. Here and there, I could get them tested through the NIH, but, you know, I really didn't have a biology department who could test the stuff, so I don't know whether they were good or bad. Here was the situation. The amantadine, which at one time was the only antiviral drug on the market, and I was really working on derivatives, analogs of amantadine and some other compound that carried the adamantane ring. And when I was doing that, and I did it up until I started doing the cancer research. Up until that time, I was following the literature very closely, and what I found out was that at least 95% of the work that was being done in Russia. I still believe that at some point it's going to all break out, because adamantane conveys special properties on molecules. But nobody would listen to me. I guess I'll be in heaven when they find out. But I was doing antiviral research.
Amantadine. And you have patents on those.
Not on those.
Something else. Okay.
Well, what happened was...
That's the cancer research.
Well, by the time I got to the point where... Well, I had been talking about doing patents, blah, 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 up for years. And finally, I got one thing that I had lots of work on it, and I decided, okay, I'm going to write this patent application myself, because the college would not hire me a lawyer, okay? And so I learned how to, I learned how to write a patent application. I paid my way up to an independent investigator's patent conference, and I learned some stuff up there. I wrote it, and I got it. Now, this one really is involved with, it's a synthesis thing, and it really is a way of preparing amides. But what you use involves a fluorine compound. Because, see, although I wasn't doing F19 or NMR looking for the physical data, I was using it in my synthetic work. And so I read fluorine books. And on this particular one, I discovered how you could do certain things with that compound. And so I wrote it, and I got the patent, but the next one was the one on breast cancer drugs, and it's really, they call it proliferative disorder, mm-hmm. but it's really only thing we tested it for was breast cancer drugs. The interesting thing about it, though, and this is really what bothers me so much, is that thing that's called Chalcone, that thing will do almost anything. They have a whole book out on them. What we did was we put adamantane on it. And if you look in the U.S. Patent and Trademark, in that website, and you look under patents, and you put down adamantyl chalcone, there are two of them. They're the only two that in that thing up there. And I know that it would do much more than what we did. The only reason I got that one and got it finished was because I had hired a fella who had his master's from Atlanta University, no, CAU. I had hired him as an instrument technician and a person who would teach my classes when I had to go to board meetings, because I was faculty representative to the board. And so I found out later that he had completed all his work for his doctorate except his dissertation. And they said that they told me that the work, the research that he was doing over here for me, he could use for his dissertation. So that work came out of his dissertation.
Oh, so it's in his dissertation. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
That's the only dissertation that I have ever supervised. When I first came here, we had all the undergraduate chemistry departments had an arrangement with the Atlanta University, and so we got master's degree students, and I had about, I think I managed to have about three or four master's degree candidates.
Okay. You want a break, or?
Yeah, we can take a break.
Yeah, okay.
Alright.
Okay, tell me about, let's see, we're resuming, and trying to figure out where we were.
You're an endowed professor, the Fuller E. Calloway Professor at Lamaris Brown. Tell me about the Fuller E. Calloway Professor.
Okay.
Chip.
I was awarded that chair. Actually, very early in my career here. The Calloway Trust the Calloway people have an endowment for bringing faculty members to every four-year college or university in Georgia, and some schools have more than one. But the idea is to enable the college to attract and maintain good faculty members. And they are talking about teaching faculty, not research faculty.
Okay. And so it's every college in Georgia, not just HBCUs.
Every four-year college or university can have at least one. They may have more than one.
Okay.
And what happens is the college or university must nominate a person and send in their vita, and I guess that's all. And they have a committee who reviews the CV,
mm-hmm.
and then they decide whether or not to grant it. Some people think that just because your name is sent in, or just because they're an institution, that they would get it. I remember one time when I was sick. I guess people thought I was going to die. I don't know. But I understand that there was some discussion going on about who was going to get the Callaway chair. But it's not that easy. That committee has to review your files and decide whether or not you get it. And there have been some colleges who had Callaway chairs that didn't have anybody in them because, as I understand it, they would not accept the people who were sent up there. And the Callaway chair is is not a full chair in the sense that it pays one salary. What they do is you have a base salary from the institution, and then the Callaway Chair Trust will add 50% of your base salary on top of what the college gives you. And they have rules like you must be the highest paid faculty member in your department before you can even get it, and they have a few other rules.
But you can't use that money for research?
No.
Okay.
It's salary.
Yeah, okay.
Salary.
You were talking about grant writing for the university for undergraduate research. Tell me about that.
Well, actually, I really haven't written a grant for undergraduate research, but I have written grants to the U.S. Department of Education for upgrading, you know, science. And I think the last one I did was for chemistry. In the past, I've also written grants for upgrading science, which included biology and mathematics. In the last one that I did, I included undergraduate research in the grant, but it wasn't just for research. I have never sent a proposal in just for undergraduate research. Although in our department we always had a requirement for students to do undergraduate research.
Oh, I'm sort of put the cart before the horse. What's your current status at the university?
That's kind of funny because when I came back after my stroke, I came back as a Callaway professor and advisor to the president. And then... about the next semester, he decided he wanted to appoint me vice president for academic affairs. You probably don't want to print this, but I explained to him that as far as I knew, the Callaway people, the Callaway Trust, did not allow you to be in an administrative position. And he said that they told him that All the college had to do was offer one course. Because when I was sick, the Callaway people didn't know I was sick. And when they found out that I had been out sick, they told him that they thought I had retired. And they told him that they would give me the Callaway chair back if I came back. Now, I'm not sure whether or not the president told them that he put me in this position or not. And I don't know whether or not they said I could be in this position, to tell you the truth. Now see, I have been interim president twice at Marsh Brown. I have been a dean. The first administrative job beyond the department head, they don't care if you're the department head, you can have it when you're a department head. But when I became dean, I gave it up. And the board promised me that when I came out, they would give it back to me. But since that time, when I went into interim president's position in 1992, I found out that all I had to do was request a leave of absence from the Callaway chair. And that's what I did. And so when I got out of the interim president's position, I got it back, and that happened in 1998 as well. So you asked me what is my current title. My current title is Fuller E. Calloway Professor of Chemistry and Vice President for Academic Affairs.
And which you do still teach a course?
Yes.
Okay. What do you teach?
I teach a liberal arts course. It's called Investigating Chemistry, a Forensic Science Perspective.
Forensic Science.
Mm-hmm. CSI.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to tell? Oh, Morris Brown, I guess we should clarify the fact that Morris Brown is still active, even though it's lost its accreditation.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me, tell us about that.
Well, we lost our accreditation in December of 2002. And when we notified SACS, SAC stands for the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools. When we notified them that we wanted to appeal, they reinstated our accreditation. And what happened was during that time, we had an accelerated semester, and we graduated our students 360-something, I think, in March. And we lost the appeal, and on April the 2nd, we lost our accreditation. And it was very clear that we did not lose our accreditation because of academics, about neither the faculty nor the curriculum or anything like that were responsible for our losing our accreditation. It was based on a lack of finance, not using finances right, I'm not quite sure. The lady who was the president at that time was tried and convicted of fraud. What happened was she was indicted really for 34 counts of fraud, and her financial aid person was also indicted for 34 counts of fraud. And in the end, they pleaded guilty to one count of fraud, and so that's what they were found guilty of, and they were sentenced to, I think, about a year of house arrest. And the problem right now is, and has been since we lost our accreditation, is that out of the 11 criteria which a school must demonstrate there are 11 criteria, and we believe we can demonstrate that we are ready and we're able to show that we can handle 10 of them, but we cannot do the 11th one because that one deals with financial stability. And so we've got to somehow raise enough money to pay off all of these bills, including a $5.4 million bill with the U.S. Department of Education, which is somehow related to whatever went down in that president's tenure.
What a mess. Let's go to some of your other non-chemical things you did in your life. You were on board of directors of National Public Radio Broadcasting.
Yeah, public.
Well, tell us about that.
Public Broadcasting, CPB, as we called it, Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, I was appointed by Richard Nixon in 1972 for a 6-year tenure on the board of directors of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And I served, I think it was 7 years, because you're supposed to serve until your successor is appointed and confirmed by the Senate. And so they did not confirm the person who succeeded me until after the 6-year term. Well, I was about to say, basically, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was responsible for policy and procedures pertaining to public television and radio. I don't want to say educational television and radio, because it really wasn't that. The corporation was formed, I think, by an act of Congress, I think, in 1967 to enhance the ability of public broadcasting and public radio, and to find, well, to, as I said, to develop policy and procedures and other things that would help public broadcasting.
Aren't you chair of a task force on public broadcasting?
Yeah. In fact, I was chair of 3 separate task forces, and interestingly enough, I think I was the first board member to chair any kind of task forces. The first task force which I chaired was one on minority programming, and I thought the best way to deal with the issues was to have me as chair and bring in some people from outside, minorities, and in fact even majority people, to explore that particular issue at that time. And we basically were supposed to define minority programming, and basically that's what we did. And the second task force that I must say, the task force has represented people from all throughout the country. The second task force which I chaired was the minority public broadcasting committee task force, and that task force, unlike the first one, which was restricted to minority programming, the minority task force on public broadcasting examined every aspect of public broadcasting, in terms of hiring, firing, programming, you name it. It was all in that. That was really, I think, a very good study. And we had members of minority group, of Hispanics, Latinos, Native Americans, and all kind of minorities, as well as we had some white people on that group. And that, I think, was the largest task force that I had, and we took a long time to do it and to write the report. And we had lots of recommendations on what we thought the Corporation for Public Broadcasting should do in order to make public broadcasting more accessible to minorities. And the other one, the final one that I chaired, was a woman in public broadcasting. And it essentially, did the same thing that the minorities in public broadcasting. It examined, and when I said we examined it, we really did studies. We had some real good data, but this one was on women, and we examined them, the women in public broadcasting from the board level all the way down to the station level. And also, that was in employment. We examined the programming and all those kinds of things.
Weren't you on another committee, a state committee, something like similar to that?
Yeah, it was actually, well, there were two of them. One was for the state and one was for the city of Atlanta. In the state one, the governor appointed me to be a member of that task force, and the purpose of the task force, I don't even remember what it was called, the purpose of that task force was to look at public broadcasting in the state of Georgia and to come up with some recommendations as to how the state could handle that. And we did that, and we had lots of recommendations which went to the General Assembly and ended up in a bill for public broadcasting. And that report helped to establish what is called GPTV, which is Georgia Public TV. And for the one in the city, that one was for the Atlanta Public School licensee. That license belonged to the City of Atlanta Board of Education, and they were only doing educational programming for the schools. And the purpose of that task force was to examine ways in which the community could become involved, to study ways in which the programming could be done for the community, and whether or not we could establish a public board. And of course we did the study, we did the recommendations, and we took it to the Board of Education, and they accepted them, and out of that report they formed something called PBA, Public Broadcasting Atlanta. And before that task force and before that report, the city of Atlanta did not have a public station.
You were on a board for the Food and Drug Administration? Tell us about that.
Yeah. I think it was 2001, I believe. I was appointed to the Pharmaceutical Sciences Advisory Committee of the Food and Drug Administration. And basically, the Pharmaceutical Sciences Advisory Committee looks at policies and mostly policies and procedures governing the FDA. And
go ahead.
And on that committee, we looked at a lot of issues relative to some drugs which had already been approved, or whether or not they should be taken off the market. And we looked at some other things. One of the things we looked at was using infrared. I can't think of it now, but I hadn't thought about that in a long time. But that was basically what we did. We met almost every month, and we had lots and lots of papers to read.
Okay, do you want to tell me about any other organizations that you were on boards or whatever that you were on?
Well, actually, those were the major boards that I've been on. I've been on a few lesser boards while I've been in the center. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting Board, I should say, that was, I was still employed by Morris Brown College, and that was a board in which I served on, I could say in my spare time, but it really wasn't spare because of all the writing and reading and travel that I had to do. I don't think the rest of the boards, as I recall, are much, much lesser boards.
Okay, I think we're almost finished. Since some students who might be studying chemistry be listening to this, what is your advice for young women now entering the field of chemistry?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think they should go for it. They really should. It's quite different now, although when you look at the CNE News, you see that women faculty at the major colleges and universities still have some problems like the gaps in salaries, the lack of promotion and tenure comparable to that of their male colleagues and that kind of thing. But there are lots of women in corporate, I guess I should say, not so much in corporate America, but in the chemical industry. And that was not the case when I came out. Although I chose to come to a black college because it was my aim to contribute to the civil rights movement in that respect. But even if I had not selected, if I had not chosen to come to a black college, I probably would have gotten hired in a college, another college or university, but I don't think my chances in the chemical industry would have been too bright.
So what would your recommendation be now? Should women go into industry or what?
Well, I think we need as many women women in industry as possible, but at the same time, I think we probably need more women in colleges and universities, and that is not only in black colleges, but in all colleges and universities, because there aren't too many out there, and they certainly lag behind men in their ranks, say professorship. Associate professorship. There aren't many women in those positions. And I would say to any women out there, whether they are white, black, any kind of minorities, I think they should study chemistry if they like it. You have to love chemistry in order to put up with all the stuff you have to do. You really have to love it. And I love chemistry. And so I went through school, graduate school, all of that. When I was in graduate school at the University of Chicago, almost every week I would ask myself, why am I doing this? Oh, man, I could be somewhere in a job. But you have to decide you want to do it and you want to be the best you can be in whatever field you choose. But in chemistry, it's hard work. When I came to Morris Brown, Vice President for Academic Affairs told me that this is a teaching institution, and if you want to do research, you do that on your own time. And I did it on my own time. I worked in the evening, and on Saturdays and Sundays, I should have been going to church, I guess, but on Saturdays and Sundays, I came up here and worked all day and into the evening. And the rest of the week, I worked into the evening. That's how I was determined that I could do research. I had finished the University of Chicago with straight A's in research, and that said that I should be able to do research, and I was determined to do it. But more importantly, I love research, and I still love research. But you really have to be committed to it, to do what it takes.
Some of the women have problems with family life. I know you were married.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about how you managed family life with your career.
Well, when I was divorced in 77, so that was like way back when. When I was married, though, I cooked, I cleaned, I did everything you're supposed to do, but I must say my husband at that time he would help around the house, he would iron and, you know, do things like that. So I don't really think that my not being able to do what I was supposed to do at home had anything to do with my divorce. Because at that time, you know, we had not been liberated, so we didn't know we weren't supposed to be cooking and cleaning and all that. And I did all that, as well as I went through graduate school. I was married, and I came home, I cooked, and I cleaned, and I, you know, ironed and all of that. When I was married.
Tell me about your son.
My son.
What does he do now?
My son, it works. He is a computer science analyst. He graduated from Southwest High School. I think it was in 81. He went to the University of Georgia. He got his degree in computer science. And currently, he's working as a computer science analyst for, I think it's the Citigroup.
So, is there anything more you want to say, or shall I say thank you, Dr. Anderson?
I don't think I have anything else to say.
Okay.
I would like to tell you one other thing.
Okay.
And this relates to the fact of being a woman. I think it relates to being a woman in chemistry, perhaps being in science, period. I have always had to prove myself wherever I went. I had to prove myself at Chicago. When I proved myself, I didn't have any more trouble. When I went to Georgia Tech as a postdoc, I had to prove myself. After I proved myself, I didn't have any problem. In fact, the person that I was working for told me whenever I would come up to him after I had proved myself, he would say, he would tell me something. I think I'm going to do such and such a thing. And then he would listen to my opinion, and he would say, because I would say, well, you can't do it. You can't do that because, and I would explain why, and then he would say, oh, you just spoiled my day. But he listened to me after I had proved myself. Before that time, I would tell him something, and he would ignore it and keep on talking. When I went out to the rocket lab at Edwards Air Force Base in California, I was put on a particular research project, and it was very similar to one which some people had been describing in the literature. But I tried to explain to my advisor that we could not do the same thing. And basically it was because what he wanted to do involved the salt in the product, and they didn't have a salt. And I tried to explain to him that we need a different kind of solvent and all of that. And somehow they didn't pay me any attention. They just had me doing the same thing the people had in the literature. And actually, one time one of the fellas said, I had asked him to do some NMR work for me, and he told me about 2 weeks later, he said he didn't understand why I had asked him to do it. It was really tracking a reaction. But he didn't understand that you could do that. But in the end, I gave we were giving presentations every week or two, and we just give, but not really give a seminar, but we get them to talk about where we were. Anyway, I did a seminar at the end of the summer, and I started from the beginning, and I talked about what I was supposed to be doing, and I explained that why we shouldn't use the solvent that those other people used, and I went on. There was one person in there who knew what I was talking about. He was a civilian employee, and he started asking questions, and he agreed with me. But by that time, it's time for me to come home. But the point is, they didn't pay me any attention because they didn't know I knew. They didn't think I knew what I was talking about. And it has always been that way whenever I present myself in chemistry.
This was in the summer of 84.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And you were here then, right?
Right. I went out there on a grant, Air Force grant, a fellowship or something.
All right. Anything more?
Nope.
That's it. Well, thank you, Dr. Anderson.
Okay,
let's see. I got it all. Thanks.